You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts. A lot of people are afraid to look into timber forestry. For many tree lovers, it seems sacrilegious to cut down trees for economic purposes, even if you're the one that planted them in the first place. However, it doesn't take a genius to realise that growing trees for timber is absolutely necessary, and we need to do so intelligently. In this episode, I interview Rowan Reed, a farmer, agroforestry expert, and author of the book Heartwood. Agroforestry is all about providing complementary benefits for the environment, the grower, and society as a whole. And in this episode, you'll learn some of the basic principles that will allow you to do just that, whether you're looking to introduce trees to your or somebody you know's farm, or if you'd just like to round out your forestry and arboricultural knowledge. Stick around to the end of the episode to learn why cutting down trees can promote more biodiversity than leaving them stand, and whether there are viable career pathways into this field where you can work with other landholders' trees. Welcome to the show, Rowan.
Thanks very much, Daniel. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Can you please define the term agroforestry for me?
I used to spend a lot of time worrying about this because everyone was defining agroforestry to suit their own interests, and it usually came from scientists who were particularly interested in something, so they needed a very specific and physical definition. Let's keep it really simple. It's just farmers growing trees for the reasons that they're interested in. And I like that definition because it means that agroforestry could be anything on any farm. Mm. But what's particularly important is what that landholder wants or needs or aspires to do with tree growing in the future.
That's a pretty good definition because, yeah, it leaves it open-ended. It's just the combination of the two words agriculture and forestry.
Well, it's funny, we don't try and define agriculture or we don't define forestry, but people have been obsessed about having some particular image of what agroforestry is, and it's often with cropping between trees or some aspect like that. But often that is the last thing I think a farmer should do. There's plenty of other places on their farm to plant trees before they start sticking them in the middle of their best cropping paddock.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place to step off with the next question. I mean, would you mind opening that up a little bit and describing just exactly what you're talking about there in terms of, how much land you should be using and where you should be spacing the trees?
Well, there's no should be. Every property is going to be so different. And depending on the enterprises, often they're living on the property. But what we try to do is look at what are the concerns the landholder has, and if they're worried about exposure for stock or shelter for land or soil erosion control, we try to learn and understand the nature of that problem and see if we can use tree growing to address that immediate concern. And then what interests me particularly, if you're going to grow a tree, why not try to get something productive from it, at least aesthetic, and build up the capital value of your property? So on this particular farm where I am, we plant trees for soil erosion control, water quality, shelter, but all those trees are managed for high-quality timber. On another farm, it might be wanting biodiversity, then harvesting wildflowers as a commercial product, or it could be seed production. Often in this world of multi-purpose tree growing, it could be a commercial product, but it doesn't have to be, or it might be something that you hope to produce in the short term, or like me, something that takes years and years to actually produce.
Okay. So you said there, why wouldn't you get a yield from that tree in terms of the timber? What do you say to people who would tell you, well, no, that tree is better left in the ground, you know, for environmental reasons?
Well, this is the other challenge for myself, or the one that I've set myself, because I'm a forest scientist. Now, some people say, well, of course you like cutting down trees, you're a forester. But I was trained in native forest management, and when the forests were used for a whole wide range of reasons, there wasn't one area for timber production, one area for recreation, one area for biodiversity. The whole forest estate had to be managed for a range of different values: water quality, you know, timber production. What that meant is that every one of those values may have needed to be compromised, particularly if they were secondary or third values. Say timber would only be produced from an area if it complemented the other values of that forest. Mm-hmm. And I'm very comfortable with the notion that harvesting trees is an act of conservation, does provide opportunity to enhance biodiversity, gives you opportunity to particularly make a forest move it to a more mature state. And so the simplest way to describe how that is different to what most people see as conventional plantations. Conventional plantations, a lot of my peers talk about tree growing as just another crop. They plant the trees, grow it, cut them down, and they start again. Mm. Now, I've never met a farmer who says, I want to plant trees for 30 years and then chop them all down and take my farm back to what it used to be when I started, because they planted trees because they wanted trees. So the key in that case is to make sure that the timber production or the seed production or the wildflowers or the fodder, anything you produce from that, complements and supports the other values were that which were often the primary reason why the farmer wanted to plant trees in the first place. Mm. And that's the really exciting area. But for people to say, oh, you shouldn't be cutting down trees because if you leave trees where they are, let them grow, they'll be ideal for biodiversity, I say, I don't think that's actually the case, because I can show you how our act of harvesting, you could say selective or small gap or thinning, some of our operations actually create habitat elements that wouldn't be there had I not walked in with a chainsaw and a tractor and harvested a log. And that's what I find really exciting, and that's sort of the research we're doing in a range of different areas on farms to prove that concept, at least to explore how it might work.
So can you expand on some of those methods again of harvesting? You said that you were doing some intercropping, and yeah, I'd just like to hear a little bit more about how you're doing that practically.
Well, practically, I'm looking out the window and saying one of our first plantings was an eroded creek. So we fenced out that creek. You know, everyone would agree that's a good thing. You don't want cows walking up and down defecating in the creek. So then we planted trees to try and slow the water flow, to hold the banks, to provide biodiversity along the corridor. But right from day one, the species I selected and the way that I planted them and the way that I managed them year by year is to provide the potential to harvest high-quality timber in a way that, as I said before, complements biodiversity. Same with our shelter belt. So I might plant a shelter belt, fence it off for a few years, then open up the fence and allow stock to graze in amongst those trees as long as they still provide in the shelter benefits. Other plantings I've now got through paddocks where stock graze underneath. It helps with fire protection because we've got English oaks and others around the house here for fire protection. Grazing underneath, pruning up the trees for timber. The oaks provide better protection for our house and sheds than most native species. So you can see how we've sort of looked to get complementarity between private benefits, agricultural benefits, environmental benefits, aesthetic benefits, and production. You've got all these things playing. So that's what I said the exciting thing about I find exciting about tree growing on farms is that you change the person or the family involved and you change the forest, because all those values change all the time. So when we set this property up, I don't like the term demonstration, because demonstration sort of conveys that idea that I'm trying something and I'm showing what other farmers should do. I like to call this our education center for tree growing, to inspire landholders about the opportunity that tree growing and even the cutting down trees and how it can be attractive to them in different ways. And then we work from that basis. So on this property, we've got about 70 different species of tree, both native and exotic, that we are harvesting or growing for timber production. And after 35 years, we are harvesting a number of those species. And we have other species that are there for particular purposes, whether that be for biodiversity, shelter, aesthetics, seed production, native food production, and they sort of fit in amongst those. But as a mix, we probably have now about 20 hectares or half of our 40-hectare property planted in multi-purpose forests. And we like it. It's actually potentially going to produce an income many years into the future, most people seem to think their capital value is increased, but I'm not going to sell the property just to find that out. But we certainly think it feels better and more attractive and more sustainable. And we are getting products out of that, good shelter for sheep, good lambing. And it's exciting because you're always learning from it as well.
Yeah, that does sound very exciting. I think going back to the environmental benefits again, I think that a lot of the time when people think about, you know, oh, save the trees, they forget that that tree may not have ever been planted there unless it was for the intention of the timber. And if we didn't plant that tree for timber as well, someone else would have to plant a tree, or we'd have to take down virgin timber somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it's you know, just the act of cutting down a tree, even if it didn't improve biodiversity or help with water quality, but growing a tree for timber, arguably, and I'm very sympathetic with the argument, it's a renewable resource that locks up carbon. And if you're using timber, as we're building a house now out of our own timber, and if I wasn't using our pine framing timber, I might be buying pine framing timber that comes in from Russia, or particularly before the war, or comes from Western Australia. So clearly, where it's produced is important. The species used, how it was grown in that forest. And it mightn't surprise some people, and they'll probably categorise me, but I'm actually quite comfortable with some form of native forest logging. And because I can actually see if that can be done in a way, I'm not saying it's always done in a way that I like, but it can be done in a way that sustains that forest and builds up resilience and quality in that forest. So, but it is important where timber comes from. And timber itself is an environmental product because it's renewable, degradable, and locks up carbon while in use. So that side alone is a very good reason why timber growing should be seen as a positive. Now, a lot of people would say, well, okay, I like the idea of timber, but I don't like the way it's being done. And often they're referring to that they don't like what they see in terms of native forest logging, or they don't like the large industrial monoculture pine plantations that they might see in the landscape. And what I'm suggesting is, whatever you think about those, there is another way to do it. And that other way to produce timber is just as a farm product. So the same way we produce sheep, wheat, milk, and other things off family farms, timber could be a product of family farming. And I want people to think about that for a moment and say, wouldn't that be exciting if hundreds and hundreds of farmers around Australia were producing timber, selling it locally into their own community, or potentially even feeding it into some of the bigger sawmills? But they could be actually providing locally sustainable, renewable product that comes from trees that they're growing for biodiversity, shelter, land protection. You know, it sounds like a wonderful story, and we're starting to see that happen, particularly in our landscape down in the Otways, where a group of us have been doing it for about 30 years, and it's fantastic what we're seeing in the landscape. We've now actually got furniture makers now who are using our timber and setting up, their own commercial businesses, producing products, and hopefully builders will follow, that come from the trees that we've been planting on our farms. And that's pretty exciting. And some people are saying, I want that timber. I want to buy timber that supports those sort of family farmers, rather than buy timber that's supporting a multinational company or is coming from overseas, or even it's comes out of native forests if that's their inclination. So we're providing an alternative future local timber source, and that sounds good, but the only problem is it takes time, and that's why we're all getting old and why we're really keen to see younger people get involved in it as well.
And it's also why we need to start planting trees now rather than waiting.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, you would have seen my social media posts. I pop up that we harvest another tree, the one we've just had on the mill today, 35-year-old mountain ash. And then, you know, a lot of people come on social media and say, yeah, this is what we should be doing, rather than logging native forest. But I planted those trees 35 years ago, and I wonder what the conservation groups and the other people were saying 35 years ago, because we haven't received a lot of support. You know, a lot of people have objected to forestry, but they haven't been supporting alternative forestry. And it's really just been a very small group of foresters and farmers who are excited about the potential for forestry to be a positive in terms of environmental outcomes and social outcomes in rural areas. And we're sort of saying, well, okay, but be very careful what you're saying no to, and be very careful or think carefully about what you want to support. And we would like to see wider community support for what we see as exciting forestry, positive forestry, rather than people objecting to forestry all the time. And that's been a bit of the challenge. But, yeah, of course, you know, timber growing takes time. I'm comfortable with the time frames, and more farmers are. And one of the reasons for that, as family farmers, we hope to pass the farm to the next generation, or in my case, I've got grandchildren now. I might skip one generation and go to the next after that, that in a better state, and for trees and maybe even timber production to be part of that enterprise that we pass on. And that's really exciting for families, because we get the benefit of the trees while they grow. Future generations get the opportunity to commercially harvest high-quality timber from it. If the price is right, if the opportunity is there. Otherwise, they can just keep enjoying the shelter and land protection values of the trees that they planted.
Mm-hmm. So if there's someone sitting here listening right now thinking, okay, maybe this is something I need to consider for my farm, what are the main components and factors that they need to consider?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I've been to hundreds and hundreds of farms around the world, around Australia, and I don't think I've seen one farm that wouldn't benefit from some more tree planting or better tree planting or better tree management. So the opportunity is there. If you think about the Australian landscape, most farms have less than 2 or 3% tree cover, and often there'll be a few remnant paddock trees that are on their way out dying. There'll be no understory in the landscape. The drainage lines are all cleared and eroding. They feel exposed, and their stock certainly do out in the paddock. So that is that starting point. Think about how you could start, where would trees make a difference, and how you could fit them. We use the word fit trees and forestry into your physical and social landscape on the property. And we used to do this exercise with farmers in planning. So just assume your farm got completely burnt out in a fire, and when insurance companies used to pay out, the insurance company's given you some money, and you want to do some tree planting. Change your fence alignment with the new money. Think about where trees would should go in that landscape. And many farmers come up with about 10 or 15% of their farm being available for tree planting. Now it's the unproductive areas, the drainage lines, the exposed areas. And that land is essentially free land for tree growing, because the land is better under trees and the landholder wants it under trees rather than under cropping or grazing, simply because it's weedy, it's too difficult to manage, it would be better with tree cover, or they see the benefits of that tree cover. So we don't have a competition for land factor. 10, 15% of the Australian landscape, rural landscape, could go under trees. Clearly, it's a cost of doing that. I would argue, let's do it slowly, let's do it carefully, and let's learn from that. Start with a few hundred trees, go to 1,000. You know, as I said, we've got 20 hectares. It's only a small farm, but we've achieved that over 30 years, and I'm doing things very differently now than I did at the start. So you can learn from that journey that you take with tree growing. And then you're only spending, you know, a few days managing your trees, a few days planting trees every year, and you're planting new species because you're learning or they're becoming available. So it's that journey that I'm really trying to help landholders go on. So for people who want to get started, imagine and then start small and learn from other people in your area, learn from go just, you know, social media, go on the line, look at books, mm-hmm. learn and explore, and then say, feel free to say, I want to try this and I want to do what I want to do. Don't copy others. And that would be a big concern. Don't copy government. Don't copy industry. And be careful about copying your neighbors. They might have a different reason to do what they want to do. And in our area, we've been talking this way for 30 years. We've got we've got 200 families who are part of our community group of tree growers. And they proudly do what they want to do. And I celebrate that. I celebrate the diversity of tree planting activities, location, interests, because we're all learning from each other. And if people try something different, it might be the new thing we all want to do.
Totally. So, like, in terms of can you do something like build a shelter belt and then as the trees are growing, you know, over-sow and then as the – or over-plant and then as the trees are growing, can you thin them out and then sell that for timber, or is that too premature for them to be worth anything?
Well, what you've alluded to a couple of things, first of all. When you plant trees, you often plant more than you want, or you don't know which ones are going to perform, so you might plant more than certainly more than one species in an area, and you manage it over time. So the analogy I use is when I was working in East Timor with a group of farmers, one of the local kids rolled his bicycle wheel down the hill and was tapping it with a stick as it rolled down the hill. I filmed him, and I used that example to say, this is what we're talking about with tree growing. Mm-hmm. You don't stand at the top of the hill and just throw the bicycle wheel down and laugh and feel satisfied just because it rolls one way and then rolls a different way the next time. The game is actually to run with the wheel. So when you plant a forest or plant a shelter belt, you're not sure how – you hope you know how it's going to perform, but you're not sure. And as the trees are small, they support each other, but as they grow, they start competing. So you have the opportunity then to start thinning out trees and giving space to the ones that you want, because there are limiting resources of water and light. Mm-hmm. And if trees are crowded, they compete. So you can actually manipulate that forest to reduce competition to the trees that you want to benefit most. And you can shape those trees as they grow. We do a lot of pruning to control the branches to get the improved wood quality. We preference some species that we'd like over others, or if there's not enough of one species and too much of another, we might reduce the one that's in dominance. So that active management over time can also produce a product. Now, the early products might be, depending on the species, some fodder that you could throw over the fence in a drought and feed to your animals, and that might be some of the acacias and other products. You might be able to get seed or wildflowers or some bush food out of that, depending on the species. As they get a bit larger, you're going to have more firewood that you can deal with. For most activities, we've all got too much firewood now. Some of us are actually processing and selling the firewood off the farm. Most of it uses it for our own use, and by doing that, we save energy. We give it to our friends and family, so we save input costs to living. And some people are using that commercially in some ways, depending on what connections they have to businesses that require energy that can come from firewood. So firewood's clearly the first timber product that most people would be able to produce. And sure, after 3 or 4 years, you're getting firewood. Right. Then you might get small poles and posts, depending on the species. You may have issues. A lot of those aren't going to be durable because they're still young trees with a lot of sapwood, but potentially they can be used for some, you know, sort of artisan building products or poles. I'm in a house that we built a long time ago that's got, we use some ironbark fence posts for poles in the house. Those trees might be 30 to 45 centimetres in diameter. And then you get into 45, 50, 60 centimetres in diameter, and that's when they become useful for milling in some way. And that opens up the opportunity to use them for framing or furniture and other products like that. So, yeah, you can plan your forest so it produces, or you can anticipate trying to produce different products of different quality over those early years so that you get a reward for that active management and you don't have to really wait the long term. But in some cases, the real value comes in those large trees. So I do a lot of pruning and thinning work just to improve the quality of the forest that I have growing rather than to actually get a product out of it at that time.
Mm. So it all sounds very permacultural.
Well, yeah, it is. It can be permanent, but it again, if I say the word permaculture, people are going to envisage a particular type of garden.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Or planting, and I always try to avoid. don't fix it. If you start from first principles, you never know when you end up. So one landholder might end up with a with a monoculture forest,
yeah,
because that's the best thing for that person to do. And who am I to say, no, you should have a mixed species, multi-age, long-term forest producing? That's that sort of dictatorial approach that we see in a lot of modern, you know, alternative farming, where they say this is the way to do a recipe approach to be a good, you know, regenerative farmer or something. And I say, well, that's pretty unfair, and it's pretty neglectful of that landholders and their families' particular interests. And we try to help people express what they want to do. We make no judgment about the quality. We do, obviously, if that we think they're planting a tree that might become a weed or do some damage, we point that out. But if it's not illegal, they're free to do it. It's not for us to make that judgment. And on my place, I've got everything from mixed species native forests that we manage to monoculture oak plantations. And, you know, I actually think people have this fixated judgment about forests, but if you can imagine 100 different monocultures on a farm, they're going to be so small that from the bird flying overhead, that is a polyculture. That is a range of different feed sources and shelter types. So we have, for example, owls that spend the day in the redwoods, but we know are hunting the sugar gliders at night that are in the eucalypts. So it's about the landscape diversity. It's not about the actual system. And again, you know, there's good reasons to plant trees in monoculture sometimes and manage them as a monoculture. In other times, there's benefits for mixing them. And I'm concerned that I don't want to convey this idea that there's a right way to do tree growing or your forest should look like this, because it's not. And if you come to my place, I'll walk you through 25 different planting types, and they all look very different. And most people start some people start our tours by saying, oh, I don't want to grow timber. I just want to grow native indigenous plants. And then after an hour or so wandering through, they go, actually, these oak trees, they feel really nice. It's cooler under here. It's a beautiful environment. You go, I might put a swing up for my grandchild. Or yeah, they can see how the redwoods are solving erosion problems in a particular site. They open up because they see that it's not, there's no right or wrong way to do this. And by bringing all these different species, fitting them into different parts of the landscape, at the farm scale, at the landscape scale, you're actually achieving a lot of what people say they want, the biodiversity aesthetics, the fire protection, the erosion control, all these values, they don't come from one planting or one species. They come from the way the whole property is managed. And the same thing happens with timber production. Diversifying my income streams by adding a species doesn't have to come from all from one planting. It comes from different parts of the farm. And that makes the farming landscape more interesting. And I have more resilient in the face of climate change.
So this is a pretty loaded question, Rowan, but
okay, well, you probably know what I'm going to say then.
Well, it's we could spend all, you know, we could do 100 episodes on this alone, but what factors go into choosing tree species for your farm?
Well, you said my farm, so I can use my own example.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's good.
Yeah, and then people can say, well, I like some of those reasons but not others.
Yeah.
In terms of let's just tackle that issue that I raised before about indigenous. On one hand, I've been in this landscape 35 years. Now, judging from the Bureau's real data and our family experience, temperatures have gone up 1 degree at least. And the Bureau is actually saying in our region in southern Victoria, temperatures may have gone up since 1990, and we bought this farm before then, may have gone up 1.4 degrees. That is having a dramatic impact on which trees are able to survive and perform under that, particularly the heat stress and the moisture loss. So when I come to choose a tree, I'm not planting it for the climate that it said on the old maps that said we got 750 mil rainfall and we had a summer drought and a winter excess, a temperate region. I'm actually thinking, I don't know what the climate's going to be like, but I know it's going to be different to what it was and possibly different to what it is now. So I have to anticipate future needs. And there's other factors I need to anticipate. I don't want to burn. Now, people are, you know, as a forester, I've known fire for a long time and I like fire. Fire is a positive and we're starting to appreciate that through discussion about cultural burning. But I've got an asset here. I've got family, houses, sheds, other assets here and stock, and I don't want a wildfire. So I'm thinking about species, are they going to suppress or promote intensity of fire? And then if they do get burnt, are they going to survive? So just taking that little discussion about climate and risk factors, I am actually planting now a lot of species from New South Wales. Funnily enough, I'm planting a lot of dry rainforest species from New South Wales because even though they're rainforest species, they've actually adapted to when it doesn't rain, but the temperatures are still hot. Now, some of your listeners and yourself, you may have been to North Queensland, for example. We think of the wet tropics, think of it wet all the time, but sometimes those rains come late. And if they come late, the temperatures have been high, the moisture stress has been intense for a long period of time. And those species that we think of as subtropical are actually much better at dealing with long periods of intense heat stress than our southern species. So in our landscape here, we're noticing the Manigum and the Blackwood are dying out. They will be, I think, out of our native forest, they will be lost over the next 30 years. Are we going to keep planting those species, hoping that they survive, or are we going to adapt? Now, I'm not talking about the native forest here. I'm talking about trees we're actually planting. So I plant a whole range of New South Wales Australian natives. And to give you an example, they might be casuarinas. But we've got some good casuarinas down here, but you'll see that the casuarinas like the black she-oak, the drooping she-oak, and the river she-oak, which come from New South Wales, they can grow right up north, so they can tolerate these conditions. Amongst the eucalypts, I plant the New South Wales durable eucalypts like spotted gum, tallowwood, ironbark. Now, we do have ironbark in Victoria on difficult sites, but that's another species that goes into New South Wales. Yellow stringy bark, which is a Gippsland New South Wales species, I plant those. They have a better quality timber and they're able to cope with the stress. I'm changing over some in the wattles. I'm changing to New South Wales large wattles like hickory wattle rather than blackwood, although I'm keep planting blackwood because I love the species. And then you've got the whole suite of exotics. We have hundreds and hundreds of species that have already been introduced to Australia that haven't proven to be weeds that we can now grow on farms because of their particular values. And I introduce them because they add something. Now, I've got a particular interest in timber, and I want to learn. So I might choose a species that has a durable or attractive timber, and I want to see if it grows here. And if it grows well, I'll plant more of them. Other species, as I mentioned, I'm looking at a wall of oak leaves in front of our house to the north here, and that's my fire break. So I'm planting more and more oaks, and then North American oaks and European oaks. And I've been around Australia and I've seen oaks grow well in quite dry areas. They have a little bit of a drought strategy as well. They can drop their leaves early. So I know they're quite tolerant and I think they'll be quite resilient. And I'm using them because I can't find an Australian native species that will do that particular task. For example, I want summer, that green wall to protect me, but in winter I want sunlight to come in from the north. Otherwise, we'll be living in the shade all winter and it'll be cold. So you can see, that's a permaculture idea, isn't it? It's a common sense, really, that you can find species that the way they grow, they complement. But for someone to say, I only plant native trees. Well, yeah, what are you going to put around your house and be very careful? Are you going to live in the shade all winter, even if you're protected by the fire because you don't have eucalypts? So I'm open to all of them. What I won't plant is something that I think is going to become a weed or, and this is more interesting than that obvious one, is that I won't plant something if it's going to pollute the genetic gene pool. Now, I've just mentioned we've got blackwood, Acacia melanoxylum, growing in this area. Now, that species grows from Tasmania to far north Queensland. So I could, using my other theory that I mentioned before, bring seed from north Queensland and plant it here, thinking that it'll be more tolerant of the heat stress. But if I do that, I'm introducing a provenance that will cross with a local provenance, and that will pollute the local gene pool of Blackwood. And that's one thing I talk to landholders about. You know, you're welcome to introduce Blackwood from another region, but do you really think it's worth the risk if we upset that local gene pool, because the Otways is sort of an island? It's got unique genes in our region. So we can maintain the integrity of the Blackwood that we have, but I introduce a species that flowers 6 months apart, would never cross with a Blackwood, another acacia, and so it won't upset the local gene pool. Now, that acacia I introduced may actually regenerate in the same way it would in its natural environment. But I think that regeneration can be managed by grazing. But once you let the genie out of the bottle, as they say, into the local population, you can't get those genes back. And there may be something about the local gene pool that's useful in the future, so I wouldn't do that. So depending on how sophisticated you want to get, you'll have a lot of criteria about what you're happy to plant. And you know, in most cases, you can plant whatever you like. As I said, it's legal to plant anything in your garden other than declared weeds. The same goes for your farm. But as we talk with landholders in our group, they develop their own fairly sophisticated understanding about the type of trees and the risks that they want to take with regard to their tree planting. And we talk about it all the time. And, you know, there's species that I've cut down after I planted them. We planted cricket bat willows, for example, back in the early 90s, and they're a female clone that comes from England, and it's been introduced to Australia since the gold rush, and I planted it here. But the weedy willow that grows in our creeks is a male clone of a different species, and once I worked out that they could flower at the same time, I had to really ask myself the serious question: could the introduced female clone cross with the weedy male clone and produce a seed that could spread through the wind hundreds of kilometres, choke up our wetlands with seeding willows, as has happened in Tasmania and parts of New South Wales? The willow weed that we have only spreads by cuttings. It's a crack willow. So It spreads very slowly and easy to control. But should it seed with another one, it could blow up into a huge environmental weed. Legally, I'm not doing anything wrong if I grow that. But on my conscience, I'm trying to be very careful and understand what's worth growing and what's not. On the positive side, I will grow species, as I said before, just to learn about them. I love learning about tree growing. I want to see how they behave. So I'm planting cowries from New Zealand and Australia and seeing how they compare. I planted there's some rainforest species from New South Wales, White Beech, I've added this year. And there's some beautiful native durable timbers. Banksias have a lovely timber for guitar making and other uses. And I've introduced a Banksia from Western Australia that grows big like a timber tree, because most Banksias aren't very good for timber. I'm not so interested in the flowers, but I'm really interested in having high-quality Banksia timbers. And I learned from those experiences, and I love sharing that knowledge with other people.
Yeah, that's clear, and that's why I follow you on social media as well, on LinkedIn, because you sort of share that passion, and it is a bit eye-opening too. I think you challenged me a little bit on a post you did once, and that you mentioned this earlier on the episode, and I think I should really touch on that. What circumstances do you think it's okay to harvest that virgin timber? Because that is a controversial opinion, I think, for a lot of people.
The virgin. What do you mean by virgin timber? Native forest has never been touched.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think in Australia there is a native forest that's never been touched by humans.
Right.
So that's the first question, and I think people are starting to realise that. There was some research. I used to say, well, maybe the southwest of Tasmania, but an Indigenous researcher at Melbourne University has just come out, and he does paleontology. He looks at paleoecology. He looks at the mud that's settled and in wet areas and looks at the pollen grains and can determine the forest history in that region. And he came out recently and said the rainforest of the southwest of Tasmania is a new forest. It was actually changed by human intervention. But I can pretty safely say on the mainland, we don't have any areas that haven't been touched by humans and changed by humans. And now we're starting to understand that because we're talking about the burning history of forests and how the forests have changed, how most of the eucalypts used to be open woodlands and now they're dense eucalypt forests. They're very different. So locking up a forest and taking humans out of the equation, particularly in the Australian landscape, possibly all the way around the world, does not in itself create a forest that is somehow inherently more natural than the one that was created by humans. Because in Australia, the forest created by humans was the forest that the wildlife have and the plants have adapted to over thousands of years. So if you change the management of that forest, as we have done, from cool burns to hot burns, because we've stopped fire and now they burn really hot. We've seen the impact that that has on small marsupials and others that used to be dependent on the fungi, dependent on the species that regenerated in cooled burns and the way that it was managed. So the example I use for the Australian audience is one from England, because I think if we take it out of the local context, people might understand. But in England, there is a butterfly that's called the woodsman's follower, and it's rare and endangered. It's called the woodsman's follower because that butterfly actually followed the coppicing of that forest, the oak forest. So when they cut a forest, they cut down all the trees in a small area, and they coppiced and regrew. Now, it wasn't the young oak trees that the butterflies were interested in. It was all the other species that had stayed dormant in the soil that suddenly came to life when the dark oak forest was removed from above and the more sunlight came in. A oak forest is actually more biodiverse after it's been harvested than before it was harvested. Right. And these butterflies were dependent on these pioneer plants. Now, I've talked to an ecologist who's worked on Australian native animals and burning in Australia. And he argues the same thing. We have systems here where the wildlife is dependent on the active management of humans. We've changed that. And all of a sudden, those are the species that are becoming endangered, along with the ones that are threatened by cats and foxes, obviously. But that regular active management is important. So my active management of the forest that I plant, which is not a virgin forest, and so I think I'm pretty free to do what I like. When I cut down a tree, what am I actually doing? I'm bringing light through the canopy to the ground floor. I'm changing the environment at ground level, stimulating other plants to grow, and I'm leaving, this is what I'm really excited about, I'm leaving often a dead stump and some wood on the ground. Now, that rotting stump absorbs fungus, stores water. That water can be used by adjacent plants. It's breaking it down. The ecosystem that I'm generating by providing more dead wood, particularly dead wood underneath the ground, the roots and the stumps, is a really important activity. And I think that is what's going to bring some of our small marsupials back. And also the plant species that are dependent on having that soil disturbance, that exposure to light, being under a eucalypt tree, I can potentially see them coming back into the system as well. So that notion, I hate using the term Western view because there's not a Western view. I've just used an English example. It's a very modern idea that ecosystems are better without people in them. And if we accept that people are part of that ecosystem and that we have, as possibly the only species that know climate change is coming and can actually help our forests and environment adapt, we can start playing around. Now, I say playing around, it sounds pretty wild. Let's start tinkering with that forest and learning what disturbance creates what outcomes at a small scale and then start saying which ones can we expand up. For example, it may not be appropriate to do a cultural burn or a cool burn through an area, but you may be able to achieve the same outcomes using a small dozer or doing some thinning of that dense eucalypt forest. and providing more deadwood on the ground. There may be other ways to do it that we've got access to now that they didn't have when they didn't have dozers and chainsaws. I just want people to be open to the idea that active management is important, and then we can ask the really exciting questions. What active management should we be doing? But the starting point is to accept it. And if cultural burning and other Indigenous land management practices are accepted by the wider community as an active intervention, let's use that as a starting point to ask, well, what about the rest of us? What do we do on a planted land care planting on a farm? Do we just let it go, get choked up with eucalypts, suppress the understory? Or do we have this notion of that boy running down the hill, tapping that stick, doing tinkering with it, not banging it hard, playing around in that forest, seeing what response they're getting, producing a little bit of product and value from it as it goes? And I can only say, I'm sure if you came here and looked at our riparian shelter belt, riparian planting along the creek, and compared it with the land care ones of the same age in the area, you would find more biodiversity in our system than in the planted land care ones that have never been cut down, because I have lots of dead wood in the creek that I fell trees so they land in the creek. I take the saw log away and I leave three quarters of the tree in terms of height I leave behind, plus the root system. And I just watch the life come back into that environment with the rotting roots, the beaver dams, I call them, in the waterway. Every time you get a flood, all those sticks build up. And, you know, we used to clear all the debris out of the waterway. We're putting it back in because those little beaver dams, that pool that you get, and the debris you get caught behind some branches and logs in a creek, and then the running area, then another pool, you could call it a chain of ponds. These are the things that create the habitat. So when I was down the creek, our creek doesn't run all year round, so you know I'm unlikely to get a platypus in it. But I walked over the creek at 4 o'clock one afternoon, and I looked down and I said, "What's? I've never seen that animal." It had a pointy nose. I looked it up, and it's a Rakali. It's a water rat. Now it's come. Right. It's a higher order predator that actually it's carnivorous, so it needs insects as well as small crayfish. It's said to me, I've done something right. I've brought that ecosystem back because I've created it. And in the meantime, I've produced furniture and building a house using the timber I'm harvested for that area. So it's actually, that's, you know, my job is to just throw that idea out there and get people to get over that hurdle of saying no chainsaws, no bulldozers, no soil disturbance if you want biodiversity. And say, can we do it in a better way? What is the intervention that we can do? Because we are, as I said, a really exciting species of animal because we're able to do this trial and error, learn from it, then share that experience and hopefully improve the landscape. I'm talking about a highly degraded Australian rural farming landscape that has been totally decimated. And I don't think if I play around with some tree growing, I'm going to make it any worse. In fact, I think I'm going to make it a lot better. And but this idea that we're not dealing with pristine landscapes in the rural landscape. We're dealing with nutrients and soil erosion and pollutants and landslips and exposure and weeds. Let's let those landholders try some things out for themselves and see what they can create. And I'm not very good at counting bird species, but we're up to about 45 or 50. My friends over the hill, Andrew and Jill Stewart, who have been doing this tree growing in their own way for as long as I have, I heard yesterday 126 bird species on their property. Now, the local native forest has 35 bird species in it. They've actually got four times, say, three and a half times more bird species than you would expect to see in the Indigenous forest next door. And that's exciting because we need these refuges to provide resilience because we don't know the impact that's going to come in the next 30 years. If they just planted the native forest back, they would not have that diversity. But they've got banksias they sell, they've got timber plantings, they've got species from outside the region that they grow for a range of values. And that's actually creating a better environmental outcome than what the accidental forest, you might call it, what happened to be there. Or what we've created when you took Indigenous burning out of the equation, what happens to be there. So that's the great opportunity. I'm at 61. You might hear it in my voice. I'm just a little bit scared that people will, the pendulum won't swing, that we won't move back to thinking about that multi-purpose management, that we'll have more and more people saying, we don't want any, you can never cut a tree down if it's in an urban backyard in the city,
or the knee-jerk reaction,
or it's on a street or on a farm. It's not a knee-jerk. People think, oh, trees are wonderful. They talk to each other, apparently. I can't hear it. They're all thinking beings, and we shouldn't be touching them. But the more people think like that, the worse the outcome would be. For example, if the local council, and I could say this because they actually did this, they wanted to protect every tree that was on a farm and native trees, ask the question, what would a rational farmer do when they're deciding on the species to plant in their shelter belt? Would they plant the local native species knowing that they could never, ever even cut a branch off that tree in the future? No.
No, they wouldn't.
Because what they'd be doing is taking away their property rights from their children and potentially making their property worth less. So what we actually need to do, and I think, you know, you often talk about urban tree growing, and I often wonder, you know, they've Burundara Council in Melbourne. What is it? A tree's over 30 centimetres, you need a permit to cut it down. Mm. I can see a lot of people saying, I'm not going to plant a tree that will ever grow over 30 centimetres just in case it affects the subdivision potential of my backyard. Yeah. And that's a rational thing to do. So as a result of that, you get a lot of ornamental pear trees and you don't get the canopy trees planted. We should turn it around and say, you grow a canopy tree and we'll reduce your rates. And if you choose to cut it down, you'll forgo that rate value. So let's reward people rather than control and think that we're saving the environment by stopping people. Because on farms and in urban areas, it is the decision maker is not the environmental organisation, it's not the council, it's not the government, it's the family, and the family will rightly make a rational decision and not undermine the capital value of their farm or their urban block. And I just find the authorities and the interest groups are scared to allow people to give them the encouragement to do what they want to do. And I think if you do help farmers achieve what they want, they will plant far more native trees and far more other trees, and it'll be a much better landscape. But they're rightly scared that if they get a koala on their farm, they won't be allowed to cut the tree down. I don't think that's actually the case, but I am in my mind. We had a couple of builders on the site, and they said, you hear that? There's a koala down in your creek. And I planted that creek, and I'm thinking, gosh, do I go and take a photo of that and stick it on social media and have the council come around and say, well, we're going to declare a significant environmental overlay on this area because you've got a species like that, or the Ricali in the creek, or a platypus, or a potoroo come back. What they won't do and what they should do is come back and say, how did you do that? How did you create a forest that was attractive for these rare native animals, and how did you do it in 30 years? Share that experience with hundreds of other farmers. Let's reward you and share that knowledge and encourage others to do the same. But no one does that. And I'm thinking, what a missed opportunity, because we can actually celebrate. And farmers will go saying how many koalas they've got on their property, how many platypus, they'll be boasting about it because they feel comfortable that in doing so they retain the property rights to the future management of their forest, and that they are being acknowledged for the work that they've done and the habitat that they've actually created. So I said what makes me passionate about this topic. It's not because I'm not just about trees. I'm really, really interested in the social dynamics and the policy and the thoughts about how you actually create a culture of tree growing in a farming community or a culture of tree growing in an urban community, and how you actually deal with that fact that in our culture, we allow farmers to make the decisions about what they plant, whether it's their crop or their trees. So we need to acknowledge that and think about how we can use that to our advantage and get their support to act in some way. So is there any, back to your question, I am very comfortable, but I don't want to get to the point, I don't want to do anything to encourage, well, take my farm example, I'm not going to take the trees out and take it back to the eroded bare farm that it was in 1987. I use the before photos to show what I've achieved, and I use the before photos to show council and others that if you don't reward and celebrate what we've achieved on our farms, farmers will not do what you're seeing. They won't create these beautiful environments or these habitats that you so much want. And for the carbon that's in the landscape here, or the drought resilience. So it is exciting, but I think that let's avoid the yes or no question, you know, should you not, and then cut a tree down and then work out when may it be appropriate to actually do that to order to support change in the landscape. For example, if you let me cut down a tree, it might encourage 100 other farmers to plant more. But if for example, they came in and said, oh, you can't do what you're doing, Rowan, we're going to stop you cutting down these trees you planted, and then I go on my social media post and say, oh, the council won't let me do that, that will discourage hundreds of other farmers from planting trees. So 100%. You see, this concern about what happens on one tree in one location has a ripple effect on a much bigger landscape. And I know that from watching cases in urban areas, you know, a farmer, someone can't cut a red gum that's threatening their house, and then everyone says, oh, shit, I'm not going to buy a property that's got a red gum on it. I'll never be able to. Yeah. So you've got to be really careful about how you deal with the community perception and engagement and support and reward. And we're trying to do that. And we call that developing a culture of tree growing within a community and encouraging people who visit this region from government and industry and other groups. Don't look at the individual farm. Look at the diversity of tree growing activity across this landscape. We have in the 10 or 15 kilometres around us, tree cover is increased by about 15 to 20% across the landscape. Now, some farms have a lot, some have a few, but that increased tree planting across the whole landscape has been noticed. It's been noticed by tourists. It's been noticed by old settlers in this area. And people say, the landscape's changing. But the change is actually coming from the landholders themselves. It reflects their particular interests and aspirations. So as the community changes, as younger people take over the farms, the landscape changes. And that is really exciting to see. It's not imposed by a government program that says we want to see more timber plantations or we want to see more indigenous vegetation on farms. This is cultural expression that gets as close as I think we can go to creating a landscape like the indigenous people did over thousands of years that reflected their particular interests and culture. In 250 years' time, I'd like to see our farming landscape reflect the interests and aspirations and cultures of the people who have lived out in that landscape, and they could come from anywhere around the world. It won't be copying anything. It'll be unique and reflect their interests. I think trees are going to be part of that, and I think productive trees will be part of that as well. So that's why I'm passionate about this tree growing for conservation and profit, which is what the term we use. But you can add agriculture and aesthetics to that as well.
I think we just have two more questions. The first one is, there are going to be people listening right now who maybe they're studying agriculture, they're studying agronomy, maybe it's arboriculture, forestry, horticulture, any of those. Maybe they're in the field, but they have no intention of ever buying a farm and sort of going down that route. Are there career opportunities in this field?
Well, I was that person. So right. I did a forestry degree. My family had been involved in farming, but I didn't own one. My brother was a dairy farmer when I was at university. And when I was on his dairy farm on the weekends helping out, what I enjoyed most was that community around that. So I made the decision, yeah, I want to be part of a rural farming community and I want to use my particular profession, my knowledge, to work in that field. Well, I couldn't get a job, obviously. There were a few jobs potentially in government working as an extension officer. So I stayed at uni, studied more, became an academic and lectured in tree growing on farms for another 20 years. And then I still do some of that, but I took a package and left 12 years ago from uni because I wanted to come back to the farm and then work more with the community directly. So we actually have our community group has had millions of dollars of funding. None of that money got spent buying trees or fences and handing them out to farmers like most land care groups. We actually spent that funding running a program where we train and then pay farmers to talk to other farmers. We run educational programs. We run field days. Now, to support that, we do use and want support of young and mature professional people in science and research. So there are opportunities, and unfortunately, many of them have been cut. But in the government research organisations and the government and the university system, like me, there may be opportunities to work in that and use that knowledge and ability to support farmer communities who are trying to do things differently. There is other opportunities. I've done some paid work internationally, ACR. A lot of young professionals who want to work in this field actually work overseas. They might volunteer for a few years in Africa or the Pacific, but then they get paid work. ACR, the Australian Government International Agriculture Research Centre, I've had paid work in Indonesia and Vanuatu as a result of that. So there is that opportunity. But funnily enough, if you want to work in the Australian rural landscape, it's a little bit harder. You can work with companies in agriculture, consultancy firms that work with farming. But I will accept that it is easier for a young graduate to go and work with an industrial ag company or forestry company than it is to go and work in the type of activities I've saying. But that doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities to work in professional roles and use that job or demonstrate to your employer that complementing that activity. And so you might be a consultant working with farmers in carbon farming. You might be working in soil erosion, water quality, or agricultural animal value of shelter in agricultural systems. There can be ways to do that. But I'm sympathetic because there's no particular job you can walk in and say, I want to be an agroforestry work in agroforestry with farmers, unless you can work through some of those other channels. So it is tricky, but you know, I'll say what I say to many young people, and I know it was easier in my day, go and work for nothing. But that's hard when you've got a hex debt. And when I was when I was at uni, it was free education. But when you went and worked on farms for nothing, you learnt more than you gave. And the confidence, experience, and potentially the credibility you gain from being involved in that may lead to job opportunities, maybe short-term contracts with government programs initially. I know it's risky and it's uncertain and it's hard to buy a house under those circumstances, but see how you can actually do that. Don't be scared of the traditional fields like soil science, nutrition, timber production. Concentrate and become a specialist in those fields, because we need knowledge that comes from all those different sectors to help contribute to this. So you might spend your formative years as a professional working in soil science, and then when you've got that knowledge and credibility, you can go out and start working on soil carbon programs and soil health programs on farms. Because let's be honest, a lot of farmers don't want to spend their time training an 18 or 19 year old person. They want, you know, they're busy people, self-employed. And if you're able to go there as a 30-year-old with something to give them in terms of knowledge and support in a program, they will be willing to share their knowledge more freely. It's, you know, the formative professional years, let's say from when you graduate and after a degree at 21 or 22 up to 30, those are the years you're still learning and building knowledge. Now, you can be paid for that if you develop some of that knowledge within organisations. Don't think that has to be your ultimate job. See that as a stepping stone, building up your credibility to actually move back and work in where you really want to in the second phase of your career. But that's, you know, career advice is not my forte. You could say I'm unemployed now. So
that's pretty good advice.
But be open. Don't be scared of specialising, because what we tend to have too often, I think, is young generalists who are sent out, who know a little bit about soils, young a little generalists. Bit about biodiversity. And that's great. You know, you get that knowledge from you doing a degree in environmental science, but it's not quite enough because in the agricultural landscape, it's actually the farmer who's the generalist, and they need specialist support and networks to help inform their decisions. They don't need someone who's just got a little bit more experience than them from a different context.
Yeah, add more soil carbon.
Yeah. But how? And how do I measure it? And how do I determine the health of my soils? And what actions are going to create that? And what's it going to cost me? And am I going to be rewarded for it? So it is a tricky question, but I know it's a passion of yours to try and find these opportunities for young people, and I think that's really important. But let's find something you enjoy, but doesn't have to be the perfect job initially, because I'd like to see people be more specialist when they start working in the farming community. And that might be a late 20s or 30s with some real knowledge. So if you came to my place or to our community group and said you're a fungal specialist because you'd spent 5 or 6 years working on mycorrhizae. We had someone from France, actually, who was traveling through the area who had that experience, a PhD in mycorrhizae. Mm-hmm. Our community group called a field day, and 45 farmers turned up. They gave up their day to go and hear that person. And, they didn't pay, but potentially they could have paid. But they came because that person was that had specialist information that they wanted to incorporate into their multi-purpose complex farming system and see how they could use that. So think of a specialist, a specialty you're keen on. Learn it, teach yourself, or go out and get it, or work for someone who can help you gain that, and then bring that knowledge back into the complex, multifaceted landscape that is our rural landscape if you want to work in this sector.
It's funny, that's exactly what you're saying about that there aren't that many jobs within the agroforestry, that sector of the forestry. It's the same in like permaculture too. A lot of people want a permaculture job, but there just are no permaculture jobs. There's like maybe 2 or 3 in that country, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But if I was wanting to do permaculture and someone had that specialist knowledge that was relevant,
there
would
knowledge.
Be a job because there's a lot of people who want that knowledge to apply those principles of permaculture. But having another person who's done a permaculture design course, well, there's many of those around.
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt.
No, it's great to do.
It can actually help you and get a horticulture job too. But, you need to start with a job that you can get and then work your way up to be that person. Yeah. And you've got to take those steps logically and carefully and plan them out.
Yeah. And do things like you're doing, Daniel. Create, podcasts and learn from other people and then develop a bit of a reputation and credibility in a particular area of communication even.
And do it for free.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. You'll end up doing a lot for free. And I could look at our whole farm and say, I've spent 35 years and I've spent our family's money doing this and I've not earned off this farm what I could earn as an academic. So I forgo that because I want to learn and I want to share that knowledge with others and build that up. And hopefully I've created an asset that the family and my grandchildren are proud of. And really, when it comes to tree growing, that's the ultimate measure. Of course, you've got to put food on the table, so I've had to work continually through that process. But I've made, in terms of my career, that income, short-term income, secondary to the key of the passion that I have to try and learn and share knowledge about tree growing.
Well said. Rowan, at the end of every episode, I always like to ask guests one final question. It doesn't have to be on topic. It can be about anything at all. What else would you like the listeners to know about?
What would I like to know about? I think I've spoken about all the things related to trees that I'd like to know about. In terms of people, it is an exciting time, and it's hard to say that in the context of climate change and economic recessions and other things that are looming. But it's exciting in the sense that in Australia we have the amount of land is not changing other than around the borders with rising sea levels. And that land has – most of it is actually owned and will be owned in the future by family farmers. So in the context of thinking about if you're interested in the environmental outcomes of Australia as a whole country – lift your gaze from some of the topics that the green groups would have you focus on, or a local group would have you worry about. Lift your gaze a little bit, look across the whole landscape. When you fly across this landscape, ask yourself, does it matter if one farmer cuts down one tree, or if there's a patch of forest that's been harvested in some way, because that harvesting will just regrow a younger forest in most cases. The biggest environmental issue in Australia with regard to land is actually occurring in the farming landscape. So I could have been a forester working in conservation national parks. I could have been a forester working with timber companies. But that's a very small percentage of the landscape. The biggest issue, the biggest potential for change, I think, is working with families who farm across the whole world, really. And so when people who want to save something in terms of trees and environment, have a look at the broader landscape and say, well, the impacts could be much greater and the improvement can be much greater if we start with our worst landscape rather than just focusing on what's in a national park and other aspects. And that's not to say national parks aren't important, but most of our national parks aren't managed effectively. And if you're a young person trying to make a difference, you're not going to make a difference to the way they manage a national park, because the interest groups and the control is so fixed. But if you go and work with one family or 10 families in a rural landscape, you will make a much bigger impact on environmental outcomes than you will attending one forest blockade. Now that might upset people, but that's what I decided. I said, you know, creating a new national park is a bit like locking up a forest for carbon. It's really not going to make a difference because it was already a forest locked up with carbon. But if you go and plant trees in a degraded landscape, you will truly be locking up carbon, but providing biodiversity and possibly encouraging hundreds of other farmers to do the same. So I hope that helps.
Absolutely well said. Thank you so much for a great episode, Rowan. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Daniel. Looking forward to it.
If you've got access to land, growing trees for profit may be a good idea, depending on your circumstances and goals. If you don't have access to land but want to help Rowan spread this message, agricultural extension or forestry may be good career pathways for you to look into. Check the show notes to buy Rowan's book Heartwood, which explains his philosophy in further detail. If you're in the horticultural, arboricultural or forestry industry, you need to know about hortpeople.com, the job board I built last year. You can find a new job, or you can simply browse other options that are out there, even if you're happy with your current job. You never know who's hiring. Check the show notes or Google Hort People.